Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine. This is where we look past the manufactured memes and artificial antagonisms and instead embrace the common collective courage required to forge a truly civil society. The Conspiracy is just a TV show, and it's time to change the channel. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I'm on Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, futurist, inventor, and the author of Augmented Reality, my friend Mark Pesci.
Because of the way my magical education was delivered, the boundary between what constituted the created space of virtual reality and the created space of the magical world was like, ah, okay, yeah, they're kind of the same thing, kids.
Mark will be augmenting our understanding of the many interfaces between ourselves and whatever it is that's out there. No, you're not tripping. You're on Team Human. Team Human is entirely listener-supported by friends including Yodeling Up a Space Elevator, Andre Silva, Adriana Zaluca, Moon Sophie Ego, and Adam Wilson. As a special thanks to our paying subscribers, we post bonus episodes from my vast archive of audio cassettes. This week's bonus is the first of a three-part conversation that took place during a six-hour car drive I took with Genesis Peorage and their daughters back in 1993. You can hear a sneak preview of the conversation on your regular Team Human feed, or you can head over to patreon.com/teamhuman and begin contributing for as little as $2 a month to gain instant access to the whole conversation, as well as other bonus episodes featuring people like Timothy Leary, Terrence McKenna, and Joanna Harcourt Smith. You'll also gain access to our community Discord, as well as other benefits like digital copies of my books. Again, that's patreon.com/teamhuman, or go to teamhuman.fm and click on support. So, hey, sorry for the radio silence if it felt like that. I got a lot of emails from people asking why I haven't been tweeting or writing Medium pieces or informing the public on how to make sense of what's been going on the last couple of weeks since the election and the raiding of the Capitol and all. And I've been holding back intentionally. You know, it's pretty crowded out there. There's a lot of shouting going on. And I also wanted time to think, you know, about what do I actually think about what's going on. So I was waiting for here. I'm doing it in a podcast because, I don't know, it's a more holistic medium. I think it's harder to be taken out of context here. And it's just us. So I'll just speak from the heart here. First off, a lot of people want to know what I think internet-wise. You know, I'm a media theorist. What do I think about Twitter and Facebook banning Trump? Honestly, I think all public office holders should be banned from Twitter and Facebook. You know, verified Twitter That's an oxymoron. Official account? That is too. You know, this was supposed to be a play space. And the minute we put banks and other real stuff on here is the minute it started to go wrong. So it's funny. I was talking with Suzanne Sloman, who was a former guest on the show. And she said that all public officials should be off social networks and they should be using official channels to communicate. And I think that's right. You know, honestly, just stay off these things. This is a thing called Twitter, right? Twitter. That means it was for fun. It's not for presidents, much less for congresspeople or senators either. They've got ways of doing this. You know, I'm even thinking of going off them myself. I'm already off Facebook, but going off Twitter myself, originally I stayed off all of these networks, even Blogger, because it didn't feel fair. I'm a published author. I've got a podcast now. I could get in documentaries. I could get articles written, you know, so it's not fair for me to then crowd out the voices of real people in these spaces. It's a public space, not a professional journalism platform or some publishing place. You know, the migration of a lot of professional journalists to Substack is actually troubling for me. I mean, I understand some of them aren't getting to say what they really want to say in their publications and all that, but mainly I'm concerned about it because it means, you know, leaving a posse, right? Losing the strength of association and the necessary pushback that you get from colleagues and peers. I think there is something to be said for the professional hierarchies and collectives. There's something that can come out of 10, 20, or 100 people working together in a journalistic organization as opposed to just being out on one's own. But that's another topic. You know, meanwhile, I mean, what's been really difficult for me are the good friends that I have who've gone, you know, really deep into QAnon and come to believe that Trump and the movement he leads are being absolutely misrepresented and misunderstood. You know, they argue that Trump won the election, you know, by a landslide, and that Obama went to the Italian embassy in Rome, through which he was able to orchestrate a cyber attack on the election system and change the voting machines to make it look like Biden win. Others believe in their hearts that Bill Gates manufactured COVID as a way of forcing the world to take his vaccine, which he's somehow distributing through all the different vaccine companies that has nanobots in it that can sterilize you or program you. I got text messages the morning of there was a blackout in the Vatican, and people thought that this was the beginning. You know, some people thought it was that the Pope was getting arrested for his involvement in the pederasty, Jeffrey Epstein cult, and others thought it was the beginning of the big lockdown. You know, one friend of mine said, this week, it's coming this week, you know, and I'm like, okay, well, I'll give you 2 weeks. If it doesn't come in 2 weeks or a month or 6 months, then can we put this to rest? You know, and we've done this before. I've been through this. And it's like a month passes, 2 months, and then, oh, no, it's the next thing. It's the next thing. It still doesn't come. And now a whole lot of people, they're texting me and emailing me that the assault on the Capitol was actually instigated by Antifa and Black Lives Matter, that they're the ones responsible. And that's because there's this guy, they did find this one guy who was at the Capitol with a camera and cheering and stuff and went in, and he was also with a camera at Black Lives Matter protests. And so this is supposed to be proof that the whole thing, it wasn't really the Proud Boys at all, or that the whole crowd was instigated by this kid with the camera and presumably others there. And that all the communication over the past month about preparing for the protest, that's, you know, just manufactured by China and the totalitarian left to discredit Trump's movement. And you can hear this and versions of it on Fox, on Newsmax, and on even from pro-Trump congresspeople. So how did this happen? That I think I can tell you. You know, really where this started was when we got rid of the fairness doctrine in the 1980s. You know, it used to be that to have an FCC license, a television station, a radio station, had to do a certain amount of news. It was just part of the public mandate to have a license. They didn't think about it as a way to get money. It was really just, okay, we've got to do the news. Let's try to do it in a way that loses as little money as possible. And then that requirement was taken away. They no longer had to do news as public service, so the news got moved over to the entertainment division. And now news, this is what Neil Postman writes about in Amusing Ourselves to Death, news has to become as sensationalist and wild as possible in order to get viewers, in order to get advertisers. It's a profit center. So it got away from public service and into public spectacle. You know, meanwhile, television became reality TV. So now fictional television, what had been fictional television, in order to make it cheaper, we're going to just take tidbits of reality or get people from the real world to pretend that they're really living out their lives here. So the fiction and reality kind of crossed. They passed like ships in the night. And we also ended up then with interactivity moving into a different relationship to media, where now we were engaged in different forms of fan fiction, whether it was trying to figure out how a TV show is going to end or what's the real plot and arguing about it in social media, or doing actual fan fiction to Star Trek or Harry Potter. Regular people could then write stories and say, oh, what if Spock and Kirk were having a homosexual love affair on the Enterprise, things like that. And it's fun, right? And sometimes even fan fiction would get to become part of the canon. They would take a fan and say, oh, this is a great thing. Write a Star Wars novel about that. The problem is, once we moved over into reality TV as our substance, then the fodder for fan fiction became Jeffrey Epstein or WikiLeaks and Hillary's emails or Gamergate even. So now we are using real-world events and reassembling them as fiction, as our creative enterprise. And the Gamergate really was the moment that this stuff crossed over. I mean, the Gamergate story, if you don't know it, it was a guy who was kind of pissed off at his girlfriend or his ex-girlfriend because she got a good game review, and then he started a rumor that she got it kind of illicitly, and that turned into an online harassment campaign, and it ended up becoming a proxy for the whole incels versus Me Too and social justice warriors conflict online, and that spun out into conspiracy theory and an online backlash against women and progressives. And what it really did, what that did, along with reality TV and fan fiction, is it blurred the lines between the game and reality, where the rules and goals and violence of a computer game ended up leaking out into real life as an appropriate style of interaction on Twitter, on Facebook, on anywhere. So you get a LARP, a live-action role-playing game adventure being played, you know, outside and inside the Capitol. They're wearing costumes as if they're from Game of Thrones or World of Warcraft, only they're actually breaking into a real building in the real world, where instead of an evil king in Game of Thrones, they're going into the Capitol of the United States. Only the live-action role-playing game, it's experienced as real, right? As real and fiction at the same time. I mean, that's medievalism, and we've talked about that before. That's the retrieval of the medieval in this world. That's the magical worldview that digital has brought back, that yes, it's real and magic at the same time. And so how did so many of my smart friends get into this, and all of our smart friends? You know, I used to say it's because it was a cult, you know, and cults can attract really smart people. But usually you can get people out of cults with logic, right, with actual facts. And in this case, I'm thinking I had the wrong lens. I don't think it's cultism as much as addiction. That's the way. I mean, you'd never say, oh, my friend is so smart. How could they become an alcoholic, right? The intelligence has nothing to do with an addiction. In this case, the addiction isn't to the substance, but addiction to making connections, to looking at something online and saying, oh, this blackout in the Vatican is connected to this pederasty story. It's what I wrote about in Present Shock. It's called fractal noia, where you connect this to that, to this to that. You become addicted to pattern recognition because every time you can find a pattern or make a connection between chemtrails and vaccines, you get this release of dopamine. Ah. You know, every time you connect, boom, dopamine. You know, that's dopamine is always the sign of being programmed rather than doing the programming. The dopamine, that's how they get you. That's the slot machine. And when your dopamine starts to drop after making that connection, and this is all scientifically proven, when the dopamine drops, that's when you get paranoid. You get paranoid and you start looking for another connection. Only now you're doing it in a state of paranoia. So it cycles and cycles and cycles. So meanwhile, real people with real gripes, and I understand being a middle-class American through neoliberalism is tough, particularly in red states, right? They are suffering, but they're being distracted into believing that destroying the very fabric of civil society will somehow lead to better lives. It's not even money that they want, but basic dignity. And I understand that. They feel like they are under attack. And yeah, sure, as a progressive Jew who also looks like a cis white male. I mean, I understand I'll get whacked by the extremists on either side, but Camp Auschwitz and the 6 million was not enough t-shirts on the MAGA side worry me more than the threat of cancellation by some future social justice totalitarian state. I trust AOC with my fate way more than I trust Josh Hawley. Now, I've tried to maintain a certain balance on this show because Team Human has always involved finding and engaging with the others. But what if the others see engagement itself as compromise? How do we include those for whom inclusion feels like annihilation? I'll give you a twofold understanding of that problem. I mean, first, and it's what happens when you grow up, you know? It's a compromise to be living in a civilization. It just is. At some point, we surrender aspects of our autonomy to civics. You sit there at a red light, even though no one's coming from any other direction. You know, it sucks. Sorry. Wearing a mask is an extraordinarily painful humiliation for some people, but more so because it's been cynically leveraged as a symbol of castration. It's important we resuscitate the human soul and human will, but in a context of civic cooperation, we don't need to scapegoat and attack in order to feel alive and present. And second, I think what makes the QAnon phenomenon more than a mere fantasy role-playing game is that it's crossed over into reality via the changeover between reality and fictional TV. We went from West Wing, which was consciously fictional propaganda, to Trump TV, which is a fiction created through a mashup of news bites and then accepted as reality. The pattern recognition, the collaborative fan fiction dynamics, they are compelling and they're powerful. But this is not a logic we can deconstruct. You know, no, it's an addiction in the classical sense. Making the connection releases dopamine, not oxytocin. Dopamine generates more paranoia and the need to connect more patterns. It's how gambling works or alcohol. And yes, there's a certain generalized truth to what the MAGAs are saying. You know, Biden will return America to some extent to the international adventures and the kids of red states getting flown to Afghanistan and losing limbs and becoming OxyContin addicts. You know, there's a problem problem with neoliberalism, and Biden is closer to that. Look at the BlackRock people he's putting into the administration. But I can't go as so far as to believe Italygate, you know, and neither do I think that the Republicans monitoring the contested elections and hand recounts are somehow in the pocket of the international conspiracy to rig the election. I think their hand recounts would have exposed a computer hack that they sang that Obama did from the embassy in Rome. You know, the election, it may be or feel rigged in some bigger sense that, you know, because of the COVID crisis, Democrats got to get more people to the polls. You know, old people who may not have ventured out could fill out things in the mail. Black people who are being intimidated by voter suppression propaganda. You know, now they're not afraid to fill out a mail vote when, you know, they might be intimidated to go to the polls when there's guys standing there with guns or something. I mean, I get that. But that's not cheating. It's just, oh, shoot, the landscape tipped a little bit back in the Democrats' favor. And what the Q and Trump people are really looking at here is whether American democracy inevitably favors neoliberalism and foreign wars and a totalitarian purge of anyone whose language or appearance violates social norms. You know, and they're seeing it as something that needs to be dismantled entirely. Conspiracy theories would be good for tearing the whole thing down if that's the only way through. But something about the march on the Capitol by armed and costumed people looking to arrest the very workings of government through physical intervention, it felt like too much to a lot of us. You know, it's one thing to threaten mob violence the way they did outside the vote counting in the Florida Bush-Gore recount, but it's another to beat police officers to death or to go in and try to hang the vice president. You know, there's no equivalent between that and a Black Lives Matter march. So yeah, there is danger here. Things are getting violent to the point where our military's generals are issuing orders and encouragement to troops in public letters. Trump and his successors' cynicism is a crime, not just against the left, but against the white men of America that they're pretending to empower. They have set the cause of true racial and gender reconciliation for their followers back a decade or more and seduced too many people with dreams of instant liberation. You know, that sort of human freedom is a longer and harder process. It's not going to be as satisfying moment to moment as piecing together a theory or playing a fantasy role-playing game. That is total fun. And even when it's not fun, it releases another shot of dopamine, pushing the cycle. But it does not engender a soft, open, empathetic human bearing. Those who would throw off the yoke of civil society and reestablish a might makes right or authoritarian state, they're not really thinking this through. But I think the rule of law actually slows things down. It gives us more time to mitigate the impact of corporations and cabals that otherwise rule our world. And all this paranoid activity, you know, it also engenders animosity between people who should be allies, between me and my friends who agree that neoliberalism is out of control. They create this irreconcilable tension, you know, between me and my friends, which is really just a hint of how effective the polarization campaign against us is working. It's okay to seek a compromised, incomplete, unsatisfying middle ground. That's where I live, in an unsatisfying middle ground. Turns out we don't have an easy solution for democracy or human civilization. It's a struggle. It happens way too slowly, and sense-making will always leave us feeling incomplete. It's just too complex. That goes for those of us trying to understand why people are marching on the Capitol, believing that government is part of some anti-human global conspiracy or supporting a crime family over the rule of law. Our brains are being trained to seek certain and totalizing answers and to be intolerant of the incomplete and unresolved state in which we actually live. The only choice, I feel, in such an environment is to turn to your actual neighbors and address real problems, engage in mutual aid, do favors for people, take our eyes off the screens and feeds and back onto the other people in our world. The screens only show us what's wrong and turn any potential activism into some version of fan fiction through which we attempt to interact en masse with the mostly obsolete top-down systems of our society. No wonder we are so frustrated. But the real world, it's way more accessible, even under a pandemic. It's not even about making friends with all of these people, but cooperating and solving problems together. The hands-on practical work toward creating food security for people around us, creating Wi-Fi mesh networks for kids who can't get to school and don't have good access, community outreach for healthcare, elder care. There's real service we can do today to relieve pressure, make us less angry and paranoid, and demonstrate alternatives to addiction and replace dopamine with oxytocin. Turning away from Twitter is not some luxury of being privileged. Staying on those platforms or glued to the cable networks, that's a sign of privilege. It's okay to stop watching the show and get on with the real work. That's independence. That's autonomy. That's a path to civic health. That's the way to break the cycle of addiction. Find the others. Don't try to convince them of anything. Just work and play together and create a reality that contradicts the ones on the screen. Life on the screen is soon coming off the screen to a reality near you. My good friend Mark Pesci, he knows a whole lot about alternate realities and wrote a very compelling account of the past and future possibilities for augmented reality in a book of that name, as well as just what this means for the future of being human. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Doug. How are you?
Good. It's been a while.
It has been too long.
Yeah. Well, that's what happens when we live on opposite sides of the world, but it's no excuse.
Opposite sides of the world, and we've also experienced about 10,000 years of linear time in the past 10 months. So there's that as well.
Oh, God. I know. It certainly feels that way.
Yeah.
But and in that 10,000 years, you published a new book, Augmented Reality, which I'm really happy about. Just in case, because we have all sorts of people listening to this show. I loved when you first described virtual reality in here. And it was something, and I'm going to use it for all my students and everybody in the future, that you were describing some of the earliest virtual reality. And I always think of early virtual reality as like, you know, movies like Lawnmower Man or Warren Robinette putting, you know, headsets on people to fix airplanes and stuff. And you talked about it as like Windows. You know, the graphical user interface as the first VR. And that was really novel.
I mean, I think part of what I wanted to do a lot of times, and I feel as though this is part of the framing that's used to push a technology onto people, is that it seems like it's descended from the heavens, that it has no antecedents, that there's no historical continuity here, right? And instead, what I want to do is go, actually, no, all of these things are like all of these other things. Here's maybe where it's a little bit different, but here's where it sits in the grand tradition of all of the stuff that we've been doing since Ivan Sutherland touched a light pen. And this is the thing, you're really pointing all the way back to Sketchpad, which is the very first interactive app from 1963. So almost as old as I am. And there's a straight line between touching that light pen to the display and drawing things to everything that we get in virtual reality and everything we get in augmented reality. And of course, Ivan Sutherland invented both of those. He invented the interactive application with Sketchpad and then went on to invent AR and VR with something called the Sword of Damocles.
Right. But I love that, too, because what you're doing by doing that, and you're not being some crazy old historian or whatever, but you're kind of being the opposite of the way most of the kind of tech dudes I talk to today are, where they treat every tiny iteration that they might, some incremental change they may have come up with or some new wording for something, as if they've like reinvented gold or something, you know, like they're everything has to be novel and new, as if they're the value of something is its newness and novelty rather than its connection to a lineage, to a history.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I feel as though it's marketing. And the question is whether that's marketing being faced out into the world or it's marketing for the venture capitalists and for the people who are being sort of worked 18 hours a day by the founders and all of that. It feels as though that kind of excitement is extractive rather than celebratory.
Right. And it's erasing rather than additive, you know?
Exactly.
I would so much rather feel like, oh, I'm improving on, you know, Buckminster Fuller's dome here. Not, you know what I mean? That I'm part of something. That was the whole, you know, the whole rabbinic tradition was that, well, as Rabbi Eliezer said to Shmuley, said to this, you know, exactly. But I'm thinking a little more, a little bit to the left, you know, or whatever, you know?
Yeah. And it feels... Because as AR arrives more and more, and as you get the glasses that Zuckerberg will give us and probably Tim Cook will give us over the next couple of years, it's going to feel like it's going to be built like it's this entirely new thing and da-da-da-da-da, it's the big new thing, it'll replace the smartphone, all of that. And some of that is possibly true, but all of it sort of takes it out of context of this is really just the next step in a tradition of how we make the interface or bring the interface ever closer to our skin, right? It's that. Right. So it's no longer out there. It's no longer at the end of your arm or out there in the world with a button you press or keys that you type or a mouse that you move, but it's literally just on your head all of the time and your gaze is being tracked and your position and your location and the world is being scanned around you in order to create this very richly detailed representation.
Right. And the difference really between, you know, VR and AR is that, you know, VR kind of replaces your reality and AR is more like an overlay of some kind.
And I feel as though, you know, people are starting to go, well, we've had really good VR for about 5 years now, since about 2016. Why hasn't it taken off? We did everything right. What happened? And it's because when push comes to shove, most people do not want to be taken out of the world. All right. It's too big an ask for most of the people, most of the time. Some people will do it for a short while for gaming. Some people will do it for certain kinds of industrial or training tasks. But in general, nah, sorry. Like the world, gonna stay. Particularly because this is where all the people are. The persistent problem in virtual reality after 30 years is you still can't get two people in it. I mean, you can maybe get one person in if you stick their head in, but you can't even get two people in.
Well, I mean, one person, you read a book alone. Mm. I mean, but I can read a book and be in a room and still cuddle with somebody while I'm reading the book.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And that's the thing. So augmented reality adds to the world rather than taking you out of the world. And so the speed bump there for people is going to be so much lower. And the thing is, we already know this is the case because I opened the book with a story about when Pokemon Go was released in 2016, right? And in Australia, where I live, in Australia, Pokemon Go was released about 48 hours before everywhere else in the world because Niantic, the company that makes it, was basically taking the servers out for a drive, make sure they could handle the traffic. And it was literally like a mind bomb got dropped all across Australia. And I was running around Sydney with a friend who was visiting from America. It was her first trip, so I was taking her to see the sights. We were over at the Opera House doing this and that. We saw these groups of young people sort of in their early 20s who were all sort of crowded together around their phones. And we did go up and keep on asking, what are you doing? Oh, we're playing Pokemon Go. We're playing Pokemon Go. We're playing Pokemon Go. So there was like a spell that had been cast. And 2 days after that, so on the Tuesday night, there's a public park, and it is a little postage stamp-sized public park, which is basically a place to walk the dog and get the kids on the swing set. And it's surrounded by apartment towers. It's in a suburb called Rhodes, about 10, 15 Ks outside of downtown. It is right next to a train station, so super easy to get to. So this is Peg Patterson Park. At 11 p.m. on Tuesday night, in the middle of July, which is winter here, so it's going to be cold, right? There were 800 people at that park all playing Pokemon Go because Niantic had a map of this park from an earlier version of a game called Ingress, which was their first augmented reality game. And because they knew about the park, they were able to put a Poke Gym and a Poke Stop in the park.
Yeah.
And the first players who came to the park found out, and they messaged some friends who messaged some friends who messaged some, and all of a sudden, the police have to come because no one in these apartment blocks can get any sleep because it's a Tuesday night at 11 p.m. and there's 800 kids who are having a great time but shouldn't really be there then.
Right. Well, that's the thing with even pre-AR, although you could say some of these map programs are like AR, you know, you could have a Waze, you know, Waze can decide that, oh, there's a block over there, we're going to send everybody this way. And all of a sudden, some little street in the middle of nowhere has all the Waze traffic coming through it.
And this is the sort of the first bottom line statement of my book, which is that when you change space, when you write something into space, so when Waze says come here, or Niantic says poke a stop there, you change our behavior in space. Right? And this is the thing. We're gonna start doing this lots because that technology is now gonna be out there at scale. And so we now have to think about what it means to be able to willy-nilly write on space with messages that will other people will see and will shape their behavior in that space.
Right. I mean, and this is real. It's just a different level. I mean, this is what, you know, Jacques Ellul, I teach propaganda at college, you know, and Jacques Ellul talked about how the real propaganda feeds back into reality because you change the way people think, then you change their behavior, then they change the world.
Yes.
But this is literal. This is
exactly.
this is mechanical. You
know, so typical for technology to take something that's figurative and then to make it completely literal, right? That's the thing.
Exactly. That's what it keeps doing. I mean, I keep thinking about, you know, when I was reading your book and thinking about AR, I kept thinking about, I forgot what it was called. Like what was his name? Like Tinky Winky or Tiddly Widdly? There was this rabbit character on TV when I was a kid in the 60s. And you would get this plastic thing and put it over the TV screen. And then you draw with like a wax crayon, like he'd be stuck in a building and they would say, oh, put your magic screen on. And you would draw a line for him to like walk a tightrope to get out of danger.
Yep.
And we would all do that. And it was like, but now it's like, oh, wow. We're really starting to play with that in the world. But it feels to me not coincidental that we're also in a moment, and nothing against any QAnon Great Awakening listener today, but we're living in a world where these fantasy role-playing games and live-action role-playing games that used to use the universe of like Tolkien or Dungeons and Dragons or Vampire the Masquerade. They would use a fictional universe and we would act out things. We would create drama from pieces of those fictions. Now, LARPs like QAnon are using nonfiction reality as its source material. And we are acting them out now in the real world as if they're real, because it's almost, because we're using the substance, you know, the content of reality TV. And it feels to me like that's a form of AR.
I have to admit, no one's described QAnon to me as a LARP before, Douglas. And that's just it's your particular brilliance, because I believe you've hit the nail right on the head, because we have an entire internet that's filled with information that will feed into your own particular predilections of how you think the universe is shaped. And so the internet itself becomes the perfect mirror for your role playing. And so we use all of that. And the thing that's both confronting and promising at the same time about augmented reality is that it allows us to bring together this enormous world of human information that we have spent 30 years bringing into cyberspace, right? This 30-year process. And we haven't got all of it in there, but we've got a lot of human knowledge now in the no space of cyberspace. And whether that's truth or lies or fact or fiction, doesn't matter. It's in there. But it has no connection to the physical world yet, right? There's a couple of points where it kind of a little bit bubbles up, maybe a Google map, but Google Maps really about what Google wants you to see. It's not about what's actually there.
And right, who pays to show up on Google Maps? Wait a minute, my restaurant's not on there. It's because you don't advertise with Google.
Yeah, exactly. So that's very much Google's view of the world as opposed to the world. And so we're going to be marrying this. And so all of this stuff crazy or not, all of this stuff is going to start to get stuck in space, applied to space, right? And, you know, the analogy I've been using lately is you go through, let's say if you were walking down, say, Broadway in Lower Manhattan, all right, where there are a lot of older buildings. You will see plaques in front of those buildings that will tell you when the building was built, maybe who put the plaque there, all of these things. And so that's the way we used to apply this data, this metadata to space, this locative metadata. Now we're basically going to do the piling of all of the data that is in the human web, and that's all going to get applied where appropriate and probably where not appropriate to physical right. space.
Well, someone's got to fund it, and the people that are going to fund it are the people that are going to make money off it. So I can't imagine walking through New York and having, you know, the historical or social information take precedence over the commercial information.
And this comes to a really interesting point, which is sort of the point that I kind of leave the reader with at the end of the book, which is when you're talking about putting information in space, you don't just kind of have a right to do that willy-nilly. If this is a building, for example, the Great Synagogue, which is on George Street in Sydney, or pardon me, Elizabeth Street in Sydney, 150 years old. And would you want someone putting a McDonald's advertisement on the front of that, or God forbids, something advertising some bacon? I mean, there are so many ways that needs to be very carefully thought through and policed, that there's a property right there that belongs to space, that if we don't acknowledge it, is going to lead to all sorts of trouble very quickly. And all of the tech giants are basically acting like, oh, well, all space, we can just write anything we want. It's just virtual. I'm like, not so fast.
Yeah, but that's why I'm asking the question, because you say to ask it. You say it toward the end of the book, steering clear of the dystopian potential of augmented reality, a world where the technology turns humanity into managed dumb terminals whose agency has been thwarted through profiling and engagement, requires both critical engagement with the medium as it emerges and a willingness to undermine and expose its operations, asking who profits in an era of global scale network technology requires an understanding of the systemic nature of augmented reality systems. And that's why I'm asking, who profits?
Right now, it's Niantic is making $1 billion. Niantic and Nintendo are making $1 billion a year off of Pokemon Go, right?
And that doesn't feel so bad compared to, you know, Google and Facebook making $1 trillion off augmented marketing and mind control.
Which clearly is where this is going, right? But the thing is that what we can do is we can take a look at all the questions that are being asked at that $1 billion level, because Niantic has been sued by a community in Wisconsin, another community in Los Angeles, because the Pokestops produce these gatherings, these inappropriate gatherings or riots, whatever you want to call it, but they produce these inappropriate gatherings.
Well, yeah, and they were sticking like a Pokemon would end up in your private yard and kids jumping over your fence to get it. And it's like, wait a minute, I didn't say you could put a Pokemon in there.
Exactly. And the thing is that those cases have been brought to court. They've always been settled before there was a court ruling, because Niantic is trying to stop any case law being created. Because
they'd rather give the guy $1 million and he'll shut up. Yeah.
Well, because in fact, the thing is that making case law on this is, everyone thinks, oh, that sounds really complicated. No, this is property law. And property law, we need to be honest here, it's the foundation of English law. In other words, it's the foundation of the law in America, in Canada, in the UK, in Australia. It's the foundation of English law, not murder and criminal law. I mean, yeah, the Romans had that too. But right. property law.
Right. But property law, yeah, is I mean, and we say we like it because we don't want someone jumping over our fence to get Pokemon. But property law was the enclosure of the commons. Property law is what protects the old rich.
Yes.
Property law may be the very problem that, and I hate to be on this side, that AR could break.
Well, I guess the question is, do you want it broken by Mark Zuckerberg? Because it seems to me like you substituted a slightly more distributed problem for a slightly more centralized one at that point.
I want AOC to break it, not Mark Zuckerberg. AOC and Naomi Klein and good people.
And and this is where we start to now have a whole other conversation. So one of the things that Australia is now doing and has done since I got here, right, but it is a big thing now, and it's even starting to happen a little bit in America. Whenever you give a public talk anywhere in Australia, you always open with an acknowledgement of country, unless you have someone who's got an Indigenous background, in which case they give you a proper welcome to country, often in language, all right? Mm. But I will always say, hi, I'd like to acknowledge that we're on this morning, we're meeting on the lands of the Gadigal Nation of the Eora people. And I pay respect to my elders, past, present, and emerging. And you can actually add some other things around that. But what it does is it situates you in big time, right? Not just the 1788 English time, but the time right. for the 30 or 40,000 years before that. And that means that all of the property in Sydney and all of the stories that can be told in Sydney aren't just the story, in fact, of the congregation at the Great Synagogue, who clearly have a right to say what goes on in that building, but also that the Gadigal, who still are around, probably also have a word or two, and they probably also have some value there. And this is that argument. I think this is how that argument you're making actually looks, which is that the multiplicity of voices for a space can have room to speak.
So you wearing your in your appropriately programmed VR or AR system, you walk to a place, you know, I go into an auditorium and I got my glasses on and I'm like, oh wow, who was here before me? You know, okay, so they did Pippin last year, Sweet Charity 30 years ago, and then the Algonquin Nation lived here before that.
Exactly. Exactly. Into long time. And the thing is, of course, the Algonquin Nation were a conquering nation from other tribes that were there before. And so there's right. there's all of that long history as well.
Right. You're back to the Talmud. Rabbi Ishmael before him, Rabbi Eliezer. Yeah.
So some of that is we have the potential to recover the ability to see some long time that we don't see now. Mm. You know, again, you come back to that litany of, oh, this is new, this is exciting, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, right? And this is kind of the counterspell to that. That long time is the counterspell to this, it's new, it's exciting, and don't think about it, just put it on.
Right. Well, that's really interesting, because this is something I'm working on right now. What I've been musing on is whether it's very Siberia era thought, our kind of stuff when we were talking, but does cybernetics break this linear time is an arrow Western colonial expansion thing? Does cybernetics, because it's circular, does it finally feed back? Does it force the retrieval of all the stuff that these kind of white Western tech bro expansionist colonialists thought they were running away from by going west? It's like, oh no, you finally invented something that goes so fast, it's circular, you know, and it's all coming back.
The answer is yes, but the other answer is that the mythology, that Western progressive mythology was always just that, right? And so you always know, and I mean, what is McLuhan, as soon as you speed something up, it reverses, right? If you speed right. something up enough, it reverses. So all of that is true. They've gone west so far, they're in the east, you know, which is kind of what I've done. I am now as far west as you can go or as far east as you can be, and Australia can never really make up its mind where it wants to sit on that scale, because part of our history is 60,000 years old. Like this is the weird thing about Australia is that it exists in two simultaneous time planes. It is the oldest continuous culture on the planet by a lot, and it's also one of the newest. Right. And so you kind of there's a tension around that. And as well, there should be, as the new, which is quite powerful, contends with the old, which doesn't in some sense is powerless. And yet it's old. Right. And so right. it's got a beingness of its own because of its age. And it's because the way that that culture told stories about itself in a dream time and in circularity and in recurrence that it represents exactly that.
What it makes me wonder, and this goes to other conversations we've had over time, is, you know, so now I look at the best and brightest of our West Coast going to Burning Man or even down to South America to do ancient shamanic chemicals and get their DMT vape pens. And they're ingesting the oldest of the old, at least so I would think. But you know, the solutions they end up with then are like the friggin' Social Dilemma documentary. Yeah. It's like, well, you know, it's not like they're going to sell their stock or change their companies on a fundamental level. It's as if these chemicals generate a superficial return rather than fundamental. You know, they end up coming back and wanting to sign on to the Great Reset, you know, or Game B.
So and not... One of the things that I've come to, and I feel as both of us are getting a little older now, we get a little bit more of a view that for as much as people claim to embrace change, you know, and I heard a lot when I was a kid, change or die, change or die. You've got to change or you're going to die. But the paradox here is that changing is also death. Right? Because you have to let go of the mindset of the profit or the extraction or the social dilemma or whatever it is. You cannot hold both simultaneously. And so you cannot change and die, or you can change and die. And I feel as though most people just avoid that hard decision. They really do. And it's almost as though the opening that you can have with these substances is to embrace that moment of change, knowing that there is a release, that there is a price to be paid, and that price is a kind of death. It's not the physical biological death, but it's a death of a worldview, the death of what of your beliefs around something, whatever it is. But you can't, and I mean, it goes back to that old Zen saying, which is you cannot pour tea into a filled cup.
Right. I mean, it's like getting the death card in a tarot reading and you go, but it's like, no. You know, you don't get to move on unless you let something go, unless you molt the skin, you know?
Yeah. And we, that is not part of our Western 21st century cultural mythology. It is, there's no, we don't tell children that story. We grew up, and this is going to be true for you and I, Douglas, and when I have you on my show, we're going to talk about this. We kind of grew up believing we kind of weren't going to die, right? That is a kind of thing that no one really talks about, but we just kind of had that kind of, oh yeah, we're the first generation of cosmic immortals, blah, 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 right? And it reads differently now that we're both very close to 60, right? But at the same time, you can sort of see that. And so if you never have to encounter death like that, and of course we do because we're encountering deaths of parents and things like that, but if you don't have to encounter death at that personal level, then you never get faced with the dilemmas of having to let go in order to change, in order to be able to, to put it in modern parlance, level up.
Right. It's almost as if all the sort of chaos math and new physics and quantum became this like excuse that, well, it's like, oh, it's all fractal. It's not really going to happen. And it's like, no.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, it is.
Now the arrow eventually hits the target no matter how far it goes with another half and another half and another half. The arrow hits the target. And part of that culture that you're pointing at is a culture that does not accept that limits exist, right?
Right. Their parents had Escher prints in their house, for God's sake, you know? The staircase just keeps going, right?
Yeah. So if you live in a worldview that is unbounded, that doesn't have limits, you're not going to encounter limits well. How about that, right? And this is, you know, that's part of the role of a good mentor. And I feel as though part of what you and I do in the world, particularly now, is we mentor so that when younger people start to intuit limits, we can help them make the best use of those limits. Because limits are, in fact, some of the most important things that can happen to you. You know, that you're not the sum of your successes. You are the sum of your failures. Your successes don't leave a mark on you. Your failures do.
But don't you ever feel, I mean, and I've been feeling lately, that the impact of this mentorship has been giving important people more effective language to lie with. You know, I listen to them in the social dilemma, dear. And I'm like, they're saying everything I wrote in like Programmer Be Programmed in Present Shock, but They don't really get it. Or I'm reading the what's his face from the World Economic Forum Davos thing and his Great Reset, and it's like stakeholder capitalism and respecting land, labor, and green this and money. I'm like, yeah, this is right from Throwing Rock. This is exactly what I was saying.
Yeah.
But it's somehow been stripped of any traction, of any reality. Of
It's reading to you like it's a mask, right? Like the behind it is literally the old boss, same as the new boss, right?
literally
that. And so this is the thing, because when it's read with authenticity, it's not a litany of words. It's not a set of proposals. It is actions that are actually breeding actions in the world, right? That right. is the thing itself, is the doing of the thing is the articulation of the thing. And the thing is, your doing of the thing, and this is true for you, Doug, you are the harbinger. You always get to say things first. It's good, because in a couple of years later, I'll go along and go, oh, that's why Doug wrote a book about money a couple of years ago, which is where I am now, because I'm all about digital cash and how that's going to get very weird, right? All right. But it's your doing is the articulating. And then the other people go, oh, this is a really good mask. And it's not your fault that they're using it as a mask, right? But you have to look to them for, if you've really read this, then how has that changed your doing? Right? How has that changed what you do? This is not just sitting up in front of a room full of really powerful people and saying, oh, look, here's a 10-program plan for fixing the planet. It's not that. Fixing the planet is fixing the planet. It's not talking about fixing the planet.
Right. And it requires, on some level, it requires soul work.
Yeah.
You know, they have to change the action of their soul on reality.
Yeah.
And if they don't tweak that, then it doesn't really matter.
Well, then they don't. So part of what I think you and I have talked about for a long time in different kinds of language is using technology to expand the space of human agency, right? Mm-hmm. To give people more choices rather than less. And the beautiful thing about the social dilemma is that stuff that you and I had been talking about for a generation was now on Netflix and being seen by hundreds of millions of people around how these tools were being used to deprive people of agency. So that gives people a lens, and I feel as though that's the question we're asking people to come from in their souls. Are you doing something that provides agency, right? And not just for rich white folks, because we'll probably do all right, people. I'm sorry. But for everyone and for everyone else.
And maybe, though, you know, this question of agency can finally be released, that the public can get that whole thing, because agency itself has been devalued. Now we see, you know, insects can have agency, AIs can have agency, anything can have agency. That's just, you know, a bias is agency. You're going to lean toward that. The real prize is something deeper than agency. Do you know what I mean? It's consciousness, it's awareness, it's love.
Agency is a ledge. It's a wedge, right? It's like a lever. It can get you those things. Without the agency, you can't get those things because you got no lever. So I completely agree with you. Agency is the foundation that allows you to have love, that allows you to have a true understanding of your relation to others, your relationality in the world and all of that. You're absolutely right about that. So it's not that that's a low bar, but it's kind of that's table stakes. And so, yes, if the insects get it, great. Right. I am convinced that as we exit this decade into the 2030s, that a range of animals, including feedstock animals, will start to have agency because they will have entered the financial system because they will be bearers of the digital cash that they are creating by their existence. And so PETA may buy a whole field of milk cows, allow them to earn their own money off their milk, and then allow them to use that money as they spend it. Right? That's where this is going. So this is, and then there's this idea, well, does a cow have agency? Well, a cow has friends. We know that now because we're tracking them really well, right? We know cows have friends. We know that when cows are allowed to milk themselves, they milk themselves a lot more than twice a day, and they're much happier. All right. So yes, we have this idea that agency is granted to more than just human beings, and that we will now enter into all these really interesting and almost rabbinical conversations around agency, not just in people, but where our needs intersect with the needs of other beings with agency.
And maybe the big being of all, you know, the collective being that maybe we're all some part of. I mean, I'm also interested, you know, I feel like you have traditionally been more comfortable navigating these spaces than I am, partly because, and I don't think I'm revealing anything bad here, partly because of, I saw you once you demonstrated like a Wiccan ritual when we did this workshop at Omega with like, I think it was like Grant Morrison and Eric Davis. I mean, it was like really interesting people. And when you did this Wiccan ritual, there was like directions. You like had this big stick thing or a leaf thing, and you were like, there's north, there's east, there's west, there's south.
Yeah.
And you were talking about kind of familiars and totems. And when I was listening to it at the time, it reminded me of what it's like to travel through a new shopping mall.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's like, okay, where are the anchor stores? Okay, there's Macy's on the north end, JCPenney's on the south end. There's
Sears,
the food court
Sears
over
is closed,
here.
Sorry.
But you know what I mean? So to me, I know that's a very primitive way of understanding it, but it seemed like that you were developing over time almost a universal navigation system that helps you somehow orient in these kind of spaces that then get me really freaked out because I don't have that way of sort of mapping out where I am.
Well, but the thing is, you to turn this around, you also map out by the human heart quite well, right? In a way that makes your insights, I think, particularly clear and particularly human, right? The ways that I was taught were that, these are handholds. And part of that comes from the background in virtual reality, because remember, virtual reality with nothing in it is just unformed space. And so the first thing you need to do is to start to put forms into that space that help you place yourself. And I mean that in the true sense of yourself, yourselfness in it.
Right.
Right. And because of the way my magical education was delivered, the boundary between what constituted the created space of virtual reality and the created space of the magical world was like, they're kind of the same thing, kids. So you can use the same technique across them. And this is the whole idea of technopaganism, which then Eric Davis wrote about quite a bit. You know, it comes from that idea that looking into the technology, what we started to understand is that it is a mirror. Right.
Right. It's why people who had done psychedelics were so adept at it too, because they had to navigate these realms.
Yeah. 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 And so it's and the question is today whether so much of this is prepackaged to deliver a particular kind of narrative, right? Or to shape you to give you the particular dopamine squirts at the particular moment so you don't look too hard behind the mirror itself. That again, this is where it comes back into that whole entire conversation of agency, which is if I'm saying, well, this is north, this is south, this is east, this is west, this is so that we can share a definition of how things work. Whereas if you are unconsciously getting the dopamine squirt because you're looking at this ad or whatever it might be, and that's not being revealed to you, then you're having the spell cast on you rather than co-creating it.
Right. Back to it's a more advanced way of understanding this program or be programmed idea. It's like, if you're not participating, and again, with agency in the understanding of your terrain, then it's being imposed on you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And for people who are young and people who are new, that's okay. As long as they're
as long as you trust the people who are doing it. But I do not, and I can't bring myself after 60 years of experience to trust these people.
You've met these people. So
right. And just because they've taken ayahuasca doesn't make them any more trustworthy, it turns out.
No, exactly. Against all logic and sense, you're absolutely right. And again,
you know, just because people have had the ayahuasca experience doesn't make them then all of a sudden, you know, benevolent hosts of cyberspace.
No. There's that poem by Rilke where he sees the ancient Greek statue, right? And this is all in German. But the thing is, at the end of it, that there's something about viewing the statue that his last line is, you must change your life. That there's something about the darshan, the experience of that. And that's, of course, what we would have expected people to have around that psychedelic experience. Because a lot of people in the 60s and in the 70s did, but those were also already people who were probably predisposed to going, wait a minute, I actually can change. I can change everything. And I feel as though coming to it, and this is, again, this is the difference between, say, someone like a Gordon, well, not even a Gordon Wasson, but a McKenna who's going deep into the jungle to do something versus an ayahuasca tourist who flies into Manaus, you know, and goes, finds the local shaman and goes, has the tour. And there's nothing wrong with that, right? I guess the question is, are you going to be open for the range of responses? And I remember very early in this, talking to someone who had just been to a ritual, and someone who had been at the ritual said to him afterward, I was expecting a strong experience. I didn't expect to die. Right?
Beautiful. But
exactly. And you can tell, okay, that is someone who's had an experience that has transformed their lives.
Yeah.
You know, and it comes back to that idea of being able to die in the change, right? So.
But then, you know, you look at, say, the way psychedelics are now being commercialized, and they're looking for ways to, you know, create microdoses so that you can, you know, charge people every day for this thing that would otherwise be inexpensive and let people have some of the benefits without the deep change involved. And, you know,
which, no, look, for people who have certain kinds of persistent depression, right?
Yes.
So microdosing LSD therapy, I mean, and the therapy that with ketamine is life changing for these people because they're resistant to all other drugs. So for those
people,
I'll
buy that. Absolutely life changing. Alcoholics and bulimics, they've had, you know, great success. But when I look at that, the sort of the commercialization of the psychedelic space, it reminds me of the commercialization of the internet or, as you just wrote in this great piece, the commercialization of the AR space. You know, that there's this promise, there's this light, there's this possibility that happens at the beginning. And, you know, I've been around for enough turns of the cycle that each time it's like the icky people figure out how to titrate it in such a way that you get, you know, all of the utilitarian effect, but none of the spiritual effect.
Well, and again, the spiritual effect, because it's making that demand to change and die, it certainly doesn't fit into a capitalist framework, right?
No.
Like that. You don't want to deliver people a death experience.
The net did that. Even the beginning, the idea of the net, that we would all be connected to everybody else and part of the Gaian mind, that's scary because it's like, well, my ego and my property and myself and the thing. No, join the rave. It's going to be great. You know, they don't want to come along on that ride.
I mean, the interesting thing about this, and it goes back to this, the bigger loop about QAnon and all of this, is that, in fact, the net worked exactly as planned. What we didn't understand, and this comes back to it, even the people who were building the network did not understand the network effects of the things they were building, right? They didn't understand the ability, the disinfocon, where the slogan was, in 2000, find the others, which seemed quite a revolutionary phrase back in 2000. And now it's kind of like, well, yeah, that's how QAnon works, right? You find the others, you quote unquote do your own research, you leave inside this bubble, this LARP, as you call it, of that, which is enabled by the fact that we have a global network of people sharing, if not their consciousness, certainly what's on their minds from moment to moment.
Right. But they're not doing it as play.
Well,
it's playful. But they're taking it, a playful world, right?
Yeah. They're taking it. I think you and I agree. They're taking things seriously that they should be taking less seriously, and taking things less seriously that maybe they should be taking seriously. But again, it's very hard for either of us to sit in judgment around that. Right. That's the dangerous thing. But at the same time, you want people to have as many options in their opportunities to change as possible.
Right.
Right. And that's that. That's the sticky point, is that people get stuck in these things and then can't change because it's like flypaper. It's like flypaper to the soul. And this is the thing that we didn't kind of understand that the net would create, was this kind of soul flypaper. And, you know, that's not just, I mean, it's QAnon in a particularly visible version, but it's Facebook for 2 billion regular daily users.
Right. It's funny. I remember way back when you sent me two DVDs. One, the greatest movie of all time, South Park. and along with it, you also sent me the DVD of Existenz.
Ah, I love that film.
Which is interesting because it's sort of what you're talking about, that, you know, that you can make a video game that's so good that you don't realize you're in it anymore. And you think you've taken off your goggles, but you're in the freaking game.
Exactly. And someone's got a gun pointed at you and go, are we still in the game? Right? It's like that's Pizzagate. That is Pizzagate right there, right?
Right. And you go and it's like, no, there's no basement. There is no basement.
Exactly.
Like, what do you mean? There was a basement. There was a basement here just yesterday. So you weren't really here just yesterday. You were in the game.
So, and this is, you know, and again, that comes back to McLuhan's idea that artists are always the early warning systems of culture, right? Mm. That, you know, and in particular, Cronenberg, between, you know, Videodrome, which is arguably my favorite film, it's certainly in my top five favorite films, and Existenz sort of frame an entire sort of way of understanding our relationship to media, our relationship to agency. And it's, you know, because it's Cronenberg, paranoid, but also quite brilliant in the way that it just shows things.
Yeah. No, there have been these geniuses like them, him and Paddy Chayefsky, David Lynch, you know, they've shown us, you know, where things are going one way or another, and Kubrick for that matter.
Yeah.
And it's this sort of Mobius strip, and that's gotta be. I mean, it's what attracted us to the net at the beginning, and to psychedelics, and to fantasy, and to the science fiction, was this sense that we can somehow get our hands on the dashboard, you know, the control panel of this whole thing. It feels almost like we can reach in and grab it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I mean, I think the thing that I've learned over the years is that control panel on those dashboards are located internally, right? That you change yourself. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't change the world, but you change the world from a position of having changed yourself, right? Which is, and it's weird because Stoicism is coming back into vogue now. I don't know if you've seen, there's been a lot of books around that. And this idea, this is sort of an idea that is some sense original with Stoicism, that you change yourself to not so much to the needs of the world, but you change yourself and then you have the place to be in the world.
Right. It's a bit like the serenity prayer. You know, it's like rather than changing everything out there, what, you know, how do I accept what I can't change and then change the way I metabolize it?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And with the serenity prayer, because that's part of the 12-step program, there are specific exercises, right? Because the 12 steps are effectively spiritual exercises that someone in recovery does in order to create the feedback loops that accelerate that change process for them. And this is the brilliance of AA, right, of the 12 steps, is that it is literally, you know, the first really strong modern candidate for a program of self-help, as we all know, because the 12 steps produce those kinds of loops in a person, and having the sponsor, the mentor, guiding you through their own experience of what it was like when they were doing these. So there's a lot. And again, this comes back to that idea, is that, you know, we don't actually lack for good ideas on how to increase agency and how to get people out of the traps. Maybe there needs to be a 12-step program for QAnon. I don't know. Right?
Of a sort, or for a lot of things, for capitalism.
Yeah. All right, look it. We have gone, the span of our lives, because we're almost the same age, the span of our lives, we have gone from, oh, there's this lovely Earth Day, everything's going to be nice, you're going to stop polluting the planet, to, oh my God, we have set the planet on fire, right? You know, this time last year, my country was fully on fire. You couldn't breathe the air outside, right? And not because there was a pandemic, but because the country was on fire. And this year, it's quite rainy because the weather patterns have changed. And it's not so much that people have gone back to sleep, because we haven't, but we're like, okay, there's all this capital that's arrayed against making any changes, and yet we can already see this is happening. And so there's a sense of growing, it's a combination of frustration around this and a search for a way to be able to lull capital to sleep long enough to be able to do the surgery on it that is needed.
Right.
Right?
Right.
It's like, how do we find that anesthetic for capital to calm it down enough to go, yeah, if you don't have this operation, you'll die?
I'm wondering then, is it still possible for us to engage in kind of globally civilization-wide curative practices, or are we in more of a palliative care situation at this point?
This is a question that I don't think anyone... I mean, there's a whole set of people who believe the only thing we can do around the climate crisis, right, is remediation, right, just making it less bad. And we don't really know whether that's the case or not. We do know that we need to change our practices no matter what. And it feels as though that's the way we have to lead. And changing our practices may include remediation. We honestly don't know, but it includes being confronted by this, to come back to where we started, this resistance to change, this belief that change is death, that if we change anything that we're doing in the way that we're doing it, without really understanding that not changing is fatal. And so we're stuck on the true horns of a dilemma there.
Right. And change as death is at least, you know, it's just exhaling and inhaling, you know, that if you do death through change, you know, it may not be so linear and final. It may be more circular. It may be a renewal rather than just, terminal.
Yeah. And again, this is where you get into then competing notions of time. When time is linear, it stops. When time is circular, it recurs.
Right. Right.
And on that note.
On that note. Okay, Mark. Well, I love you.
All right. Very much love to you, and happy solstice.
You've been on Team Human. Our guest today was Mark Pesce, author of the new wonderful book, Augmented Reality. You can find out more about him at markpesce.com. You can find out more about Mark and all of our guests at teamhuman.fm, where you can also become a supporting member of the team. Team Human was produced by Josh Chapdelin and edited by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff. You've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.